Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Tensions in Burundi. Prior to balloting, at least two people died in overnight violence in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. Witnesses reported today as tensions rise in the lead-up to contested elections. Voters in Burundi go to polls on Monday. VOA's William Eagle reports.
The legislative elections will take place despite efforts to delay them. The European Union, African Union, East African Community, and the United Nations Secretary General have asked that they be postponed until the opposition and the government can agree on how to ensure the elections will be transparent and inclusive. Over the past week, grenade attacks shook several towns, killing four and injuring dozens. One of the country's two vice presidents and two members of the Electoral Commission have fled. Observers say in this environment, the ruling CNDD, FDD, and allied smaller parties are guaranteed a substantial win. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
The Greek Parliament voted today in favor of the request from Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras's government for a referendum on the terms of an international bailout deal that will soon expire. Greeks will vote in the referendum July 5th. Mr. Tsipras said the people must decide free of any blackmail. The French Prime Minister Manuel Valls warned today that there is a real risk of Greece leaving the eurozone if Greek voters say no to the bailout proposals in the upcoming referendum. This is VOA News. A senior U.S. official says all parties at the Iran nuclear talks in Vienna plan to continue negotiating past the June 30th deadline. Earlier today, the U.S. delegation led by Secretary of State John Kerry held high-level talks with the Iranian delegation. VOA's Al Pessin has more on the story.
Iran does want to avoid inspections of its military facilities and interviews with its scientists. But military site inspections are part of the global non-proliferation rules that 126 other countries accept and that are the basis of the prospective deal with Iran. Ariane Tabatabai of Washington's Georgetown University, who spoke via Skype.
On the one hand, it really wants a deal. On the other hand, it needs to make sure that the deal doesn't come at a cost for its national security, which, you know, access to military facilities, to nuclear scientists could potentially jeopardize.
Public statements on all sides are part negotiating tactic, part domestic politics. But in the coming days, rhetoric will give way to political reality inside the negotiating rooms. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Kuwait said today it has identified a Saudi citizen as a suicide bomber that attacked a crowded Shiite mosque, killing at least 26 people and wounding many others. The Interior Ministry said Fahd Suleiman Abdulmohsen al-Qabaz is responsible for Friday's assault on the mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. The incident in Kuwait was one of three terrorist attacks Friday on three continents. The Tunisian prime minister scrambled Saturday to boost security as thousands of foreign tourists fled the country following the terrorist attack at a seaside resort. More than 500 people were injured, nearly 200 seriously, in a fire at a water park outside Taiwan's capital of Taipei. The fire accidentally erupted when colored theatrical powder ignited as it was thrown from a stage onto a crowd of 1,000 young people dancing and enjoying music. Dazed victims were carried from the Formosa water park on inflatable rubber rings. According to Taiwan's central news agency, the blaze was quickly brought under control. The cause is under investigation. Gay couples have been celebrating the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling legalizing same-sex marriage with spontaneous weddings and gatherings across the United States, while some conservative politicians and religious groups are demanding stronger legal protections for those wishing to avoid endorsing those unions. Marriage licenses were issued to same-sex couples minutes after the ruling in at least 8 states in the South and Midwest where gay marriage was previously banned. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The voting quorum is the number of votes you need to pass regular laws, and there's a different number of votes required in order to be able to change the constitution.
Burundian main opposition parties plan to boycott elections on Monday. We'll have details.
We want to negotiate, but we don't want to negotiate to kill the law in our country. The last local elections were held in 2005.
Guinean opposition groups boycott talks with government after accusing the administration of gross disregard of the country's laws.
He says the attack came as a surprise since worshippers had their minds focused on the Islamic holy month of Ramadan.
And terrorist violence marks the first week of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Voters in Burundi go to the polls Monday for parliamentary and local elections, but a number of prominent opposition parties are boycotting. They are protesting President Pierre Nkurunziza's controversial decision to run for another term. They also say the government has clamped down on opposition parties, civil society groups, and the media, making it nearly impossible to campaign. VOA's William Eagle takes a look at the controversy surrounding the polls.
The legislative elections will take place despite efforts to delay them. The European Union, African Union, East African Community, and the United Nations Secretary General have asked that they be postponed until the opposition and the government can agree on how to ensure the elections will be transparent and inclusive. Over the past week, grenade attacks shook several towns, killing four and injuring dozens. One of the country's two vice presidents and two members of the Electoral Commission have fled, as have nearly 100,000 citizens, now refugees, in surrounding countries. Observers say in this environment, the ruling CNDD, FDD, and allied smaller parties are guaranteed a substantial win. Party supporters say that would give the CNDD, FDD a mandate for change. Thierry Vercoulon is a Central Africa project director for the International Crisis Group.
Yes, definitely that will enable the ruling party to have enough seats in parliament with those satellite parties to change the constitution. They tried to do so at the beginning of 2014, but they fell by only one vote.
Constitutional changes would overturn parts of the peace accord signed between warring Hutu and Tutsi 10 years ago. The agreement included a quota guaranteeing minority Tutsi representation in government. Potential ruling party reforms could also end efforts to encourage parties to cooperate when making new laws. In recent years, a legislative quorum specified that a specific number of votes were needed to pass new laws. The arrangement has led large and small parties to seek consensus. Yolanda Buka is a researcher with the Institute for Security Studies in Nairobi.
The voting quorum is the number of votes you need to pass regular laws, and there's a different number of votes required in order to be able to change the constitution. But bottom line, if you reduce that number, which is what the government was trying to do in March of last year, then you definitely do not need to convince people outside of your party to be able to pass the laws that you want.
Buka says the government is using the same behavior, including intimidation of civil society and the opposition, as in the last elections in 2010. The opposition boycotted those polls as well. Thierry Vercoulon of the International Crisis Group says the opposition has failed to pressure the government to hold open and inclusive elections. One problem was that the opposition is a coalition of groups with no clear leader for the public to follow. They also failed to get the same amount of public support as successful protests in Senegal and Burkina Faso against presidents there seeking to extend their term limits.
When they realized that they wouldn't make any difference by going to court and doing some political pressure, then they decided to take over the streets. The problem is that they did not manage to rally enough people behind them, and we didn't have mass demonstrations in Bujumbura like we had in Ouagadougou.
Burundi officials did not appear last week at a meeting of the UN-sponsored talks to bring the two sides together. The chair of the ruling party, Pascal Niyabenda, told VOA the calls for dialogue were a disguise for opposition efforts to postpone elections and create a transitional government. He said that would violate the Constitution, which says the president should be sworn in by August. But Yolanda Buka says if the elections do take place Monday, the ruling party will be forcing its way to get what it wants without any concern for internal or external legitimacy. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Opposition political parties in Guinea suspended their participation in talks with the government. This after accusing allies of President Alpha Condé of blocking effort to resolve a political impasse that sparked a series of violent protests. The talks had made no progress to resolving disagreements. Faya Milimuno, the leader of the bloc, told me that the opposition parties pulled out of the talks due to the administration's disregard of the country's laws.
The rationale behind what the opposition has just done is all about the law. We want to negotiate, but we don't want to negotiate to kill the law in our country. The last local elections were held in 2005. It was for a 5-year term. Normally, we should have held the elections in 2010. We didn't have election, and the president have appointed the members of his own party to occupy all the elected official positions throughout the country. And those people are heavily involved in the process of election. We cannot accept that to happen. That's why the opposition is requiring the election, the local election, to be held before going to the presidential.
But Mr. Milimuno, the reason why you held the talks initially was to come to a compromise to resolve this political impasse. So if you will be, if the opposition will not compromise on this issue, then how can this impasse be resolved?
Listen, we cannot compromise on the law. The law is to be respected. If every time the government violate the law, we get together to compromise, but this country is not going to be a country. And if we don't see a goodwill on the government side to respect the law, we are not going to accept to compromise accepting the law to be violated.
What is the political goodwill that you want to see from the coalition government, if I may ask?
I mean, first, we can go to local elections before the presidential. Even the United Nations Agency has evaluated the situation and come up with the conclusion that local elections can be held before the presidential. And now the government doesn't want to hear that because the president wants the member of his own party who are actually replacing all the local elected officials who are heavily involved in the process to be in place to act in his favor. We're going to accept only when the law is respected. And respecting the law is to help to hold local elections before the presidential.
The head of the parliamentary group representing the ruling coalition, Amadou Damaro Camara, has accused you
and the rest of your other colleagues in the opposition of complicating the talks by constantly changing your demand, basically thwarting every effort to resolve this impasse. What is your response to that?
Is it his view? Listen, the body which is in charge of organizing the election, CENI, has worked during the whole year of 2014 to prepare local elections. But because the president doesn't want the local elections to be held, because if the local elections are held, he's going to lose. Let's say in America today, the president of the United States to decide to appoint the council members all over the country from his own political party. That cannot happen there. It cannot happen in Guinea either.
Faye Felimino is the leader of the Guinean opposition bloc Liberal. He spoke with me from the capital, Conakry. Meanwhile, authorities in Guinea have taken bold steps aimed at finally ending the spread of Ebola in the country's coastal region, the one area where the virus continues to claim lives. For VOA, Karim Kamara has more from Guinea's Forikaria district.
Three towns in the Forikaria district where the Ebola outbreak has persisted for more than a year were quarantined this week by the Guinean government. The towns are Dixin, Buramaya, Tamarasi, and Kolota. According to the coordinator in the fight against Ebola in Forikaria, Mohamed Kamara, this new strategy was put in place after inhabitants of all three towns agreed to stay at home for 21 days.
Nouvelle stratégie est basée d'abord sur la négociation avec les habitants du village.
He says the towns were quarantined voluntarily and residents expressed a willingness to cooperate. He says the government, in collaboration with its partners, agreed to supply food, surveillance of people's movement, and a supply of free medicines. Authorities have also warned that anyone hiding Ebola patients will be arrested and put on trial. Ebola has disappeared from neighboring Liberia, but a small number of cases remain in both Guinea and Sierra Leone. This is the first time the Guinean government has quarantined a large area since the regional outbreak began in December 2013. International partners like Medicine Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders say this step is commendable because the coastal region is the only part of Guinea where the Ebola virus has not been contained. However, several people who came in contact with Ebola are reported to have fled the region. Most are said to have gone to the capital, Conakry. Searches are on the way to track them down. Six new cases of Ebola have just been reported in the commune of Matam in Conakry. Hospital sources say all six people contracted the virus through a woman who fled Forikaria and later died in the capital. According to Robert Olivier of Doctors Without Borders, no stone will be left unturned in the latest phase of this fight against Ebola. He says they are going to register people in all neighborhoods to ensure that everybody stays comfortably at home until 21 days have passed. The mood in the town of Forikaria after the quarantine was imposed was one of joy. The residents say that if the quarantine stops the spread of Ebola in the region, the stigmatization they face will be over. Karim Kamara, VOA News, Forikaria, in the coastal region of Guinea.
Terrorist violence marred the end of the first week of Ramadan as a bloody attack killed at least 39 in a Tunisian resort town and a suicide bomber killed at least 25 worshippers in a Shia mosque in Kuwait. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility for the Kuwait attack. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Gunmen opened fire with automatic weapons on foreign tourists relaxing at the beach at two hotels in the Tunisian resort town of Sousse Friday. It was not immediately clear how many attackers were involved. Amateur video showed bodies sprawled on the beach in front of one luxury hotel and what appeared to be a dead gunman outside the facility. The hotels are popular with European tourists. Tunisian state TV reported three gunmen were captured and that operations were continuing to secure the area. Witnesses reported hearing gunfire several hours after the initial attack. A Tunisian Interior Ministry spokesman stressed that tensions in the region and across the globe were stoking terrorism in his country. Another terror attack at the Bardo Museum in the Tunisian capital, Tunis, last March killed 21 people, mostly European tourists. In a separate attack claimed by the Islamic State group, a suicide bomber blew himself up inside a Shiite mosque in the Kuwaiti capital, Kuwait City. The blast killed at least 25 people and injured more than 200. Hospitals called on the public to donate blood. Mohammed Yusuf, who was wounded, told Kuwait TV that he was about 10 meters from the main entrance to the mosque when the bomb went off. He says the attack came as a surprise since worshippers had their minds focused on the Islamic holy month of Ramadan and were weak from the daily fasting and extreme summer heat. He says that those who perpetrated the act cannot claim to be Muslims. The Islamic State group has also attacked Shiite mosques in neighboring Saudi Arabia over the past several months and has carried out attacks aimed at Shiites in Iraq. Kuwait's education minister tells State TV that a strategy of educating people against sectarian behavior must be undertaken at the family level in order to prevent more such attacks from taking place. He insists that Kuwaitis, both Shiite and Sunni, were one body and one society. Arab League head Nabil Al-Arabi condemned the attacks in Kuwait and Tunisia and called on everyone to abstain from violence during Ramadan. The attacks came within hours of an attack at a gas plant in southern France. French counter-terrorist forces were deployed to the gas factory near Lyon, where a body and decapitated head were found covered with Arabic writing. A flag with Islamist inscriptions was also found nearby. One person was arrested shortly after the attack. Speaking at a EU summit in Brussels before heading back to France, President François Hollande said the attack was of a terrorist nature and that emotion must not be the only response. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
As Ebola cases are falling in Sierra Leone, many fear that the crisis has affected the country's justice system. Some complain about longer jail terms and unfair arrests. For VOA, Nina DeVries has more from the capital, Freetown.
A state of emergency, which includes certain restrictions of movement, has been in place in Sierra Leone for almost a year. But because Ebola cases have decreased, some restrictions have recently been lifted. The streets of Freetown look back to normal. Vendors can now stay open longer and more people are using public transit. Isatu Sese used to sell tomatoes and other food products at Lumley Market in Freetown.
At one time,
she says police raided her food stand and they beat her a couple of months ago. They say it was because she was operating past the curfew for business hours, but Sese says it was 20 minutes before the mandatory closing time. Sia Dean is a social worker with the non-governmental organization Advocate that provides services such as legal counseling to women in conflict with the law. Advocate got Sese released on bail after more than a month in jail.
They keep people inside there for a long time, really, because that is for the judiciary. They are not doing their work effectively. More of these women are the trials. They don't indict their indictments quickly. So I'm just sitting down.
Sese says her fellow vendors are glad to be getting more business following the easing of restrictions, but she's afraid of the police and doesn't have the financial means to reopen her market. The Human Rights Commission of Sierra Leone has also raised concern about police conduct. Commission Chairman Brahma Sharif says not all police should be given a bad reputation. Many have been helpful in keeping order, but there have been allegations of police beatings including to one of the members of the commission. Sharif says there was also concern about equal rights under the state of emergency. For example, shops had to be closed by 6 p.m. until recently, but the commission heard of bars being open or permission given for wedding parties, while others were not given permission.
Generally speaking, state of emergencies are not human rights friendly because they'll be limiting the rights of citizens. For example, in this case, rights of movements, you know, assembly, these are all limited. And these are rights that people are supposed to enjoy. But then during the state of emergency, it is allowed by our constitution and it's even allowed even by international provisions, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Article 4 talks very clearly about that. You can limit it, but you have to limit it specifically for the purpose for which it was evoked.
Human rights group Amnesty International has voiced concern about people's lengthy detentions without charge and bans on peaceful protests and marches. Sierra Leone Attorney General and Minister of Justice Frank Carbo says police may have used excessive force. He says the government does not condone this, but he says he needs proof to investigate further. He says overall police are doing a good job, but admits there's always room for improvement.
There may be a need for refresher courses as to how to handle high-stress situations.
Cargbo says gatherings during the state of emergency are supposed to be limited, and that is why protests have not been allowed.
Any gathering of more than 10 persons was banned by in the regulations. And in the event that it's more than 10 persons, it has to be specifically related to efforts directed at eradicating the Ebola virus disease.
He says he is open to further discussions with human rights groups on how the state of emergency is being handled. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
South Sudan delegations of the ruling SPLM in government and SPLM in opposition are in Arusha, Tanzania, to discuss the implementation of an already signed agreement to reunify the ruling party. Officials say the delegations would also prepare for an upcoming Heads of State summit where President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar will meet face-to-face. For VOA, Charlton Doki has the story from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
Acting SPLM spokesperson Cor Paul Accordit is leading the government's five-member delegation to the talks.
We are going to Arusha to engage the SPLM in opposition, which has signed the Arusha Reunification Agreement. And so far, they've backtracked from that agreement, and they've not been serious with its implementation. So the co-guarantors have invited us, the SPLM leadership and the SPLM in opposition, for this engagement.
Accordit says he understands the SPLM in opposition is arriving later tonight. He expressed hope that these talks, which include the former detainees that have been welcomed back into the party, will finally enable the factions of SPLM to narrow their differences and eventually lead to a peaceful end to the more than 18-month-long conflict.
This round of talks in Arusha will be bilateral because the former detainees are now dissolved and they are part of us after joining us, so they are no longer an entity. So it will be direct talks between the SPLM and the SPLM in opposition. And we hope that the outstanding issues, if there are issues that made the SPLM in opposition not to come on board, we hope to address them so that peace prevails in this country.
Accordit says the two delegations will also prepare the ground for a Heads of State summit in which both President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar are expected to attend.
There are other consultations that are going on in the region also. Kenya, in person of President Uhuru Kenyatta, witnessed the signing of Arusha Agreement. And he is also endeavoring to bring President Salva and Riek Machar together to reinforce the Arusha Agreement and to ensure that Riek comply with the provision of Arusha Agreement.
According to reports in the Kenyan media, President Kenyatta met Machar in Nairobi on Wednesday. Yesterday, the Kenyan leader met the former detainees, led by the just reinstated SPLM Secretary General Pagan Amum, to discuss the peace process. Accordit says the Arusha peace process has overtaken the IGAD-led talks in Addis Ababa because there has been progress in that the former detainees have been welcomed back into the government. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, June 28th. Group stage matches in Africa's two club football competitions, the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup, kicked off this weekend. First, the top-tier Champions League. Defending champion ES Setif of Algeria was handed a 2-1 shocking defeat by fellow Algerian team USM Alger in their Group B clash on Saturday in Setif in northeastern Algeria. USM Alger went up early in the second half thanks to goals from Mohamed Segwa and captain Nasruddin Kwade. ES Setif scored a consolation goal in the 9 minutes of the Algerian derby. The result is a huge setback for ES Setif, known as the Black Eagles, which is hoping to join the Real League of Clubs to win back-to-back continental club titles. In another Group B match on Friday, Sudanese side Almerek began the group phase with a 2-0 victory over EL Ulmal of Algeria in Omdurman. Altogether, three Algerian clubs are participating in the group phase of the lucrative Champions League. This is the first time that three clubs from the same country are featuring in the same group of the Champions League. Group A, due to kick off today, Sunday, has former winner TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan's Al Hilal, debutant Smouha of Egypt, and Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco. At the end of the round-robin matches in the group stage, the top two teams in each group will advance to the semi-final. Each of the eight teams in the group stage is guaranteed some prize money, with the list that is fourth in the group stage getting $400,000, the overall winner $1.5 million, and the runner-up, $1 million. All semi-finalists will get $700,000 each, while the third team in the group stage will receive $500,000. Let's now turn to the second-tier club competition, the CAF Confederation Cup. Egyptian giant Zamalek managed to beat visiting CS Sfaxien of Tunisia 1-0 in a Group B match in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, on Saturday. The goal was scored by Abdoulaye Cissé. The Burkinabe imports scored the winner a minute from time to give the White Knights a deserving victory in an encounter they dominated. In another Group B match, also on Saturday, Orlando Pirates of South Africa defeated AC Leopards of the Republic of Congo by the same 1-0 margin in Dolise, in Congo's western province. The goal was scored by defender Happy Jele in the 57th minute. The Pirates will next host Zamalek on July 11th. While AC Leopards travel to Sfax, southeast of Tunisia, as guests of CS Sfaxien. Earlier on Friday, Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia beat Stade Malien of Mali 1-0 in a Group A encounter hosted by the Tunisian club. The other Group A match between Al Ahly of Egypt and Esperance of Tunisia is slated for today, Sunday. Like the Champions League, every team featuring in the group stage of the Confederation Cup is guaranteed some prize money, though not as lucrative as the Champions League. The overall winner of the Confederation Cup will get $625,000, while the runner-up will receive $432,000. Staying with African football, the Tunisian Football Federation, FTF, has parted ways with national team coach Georges Leekens. FTF said in a statement on Saturday that both parties have decided an amicable separation. The Federation said Leekens' successor will be a foreigner. The contract of the well-traveled Belgian was expected to run until March 2016. Few weeks ago, he guided the 2004 African champion to an 8-1 win over Djibouti in the opening match of the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers in Tunisia's port city of Rades. Likens, who took charge in 2014, guided the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia to a quarter-final finish at the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations. Beside his native Belgium, the 66-year-old has also worked in Turkey, Algeria, the Netherlands, and Saudi Arabia. In a related development, the South African Football Association, SAFA, has named Neil Tovey as its new technical director. Tovey is one of the most experienced coaches in the country, having coached Mamelodi Sundowns, AmaZulu, and Mpumalanga Black Aces in the last 16 years. Tovey's responsibility is separate from the coaching role. Therefore, Ephraim Sheikh Mashaba remains Bafana Bafana's coach. The 52-year-old Tovey will be responsible for the development of young talents while ensuring that all South African national teams have a uniform playing style. Finally, President Sepp Blatter of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, said in a newspaper interview on Saturday that he will not stand as a candidate at the forthcoming Special Elective Congress of Member Associations. "I am not a candidate. I am the president, and I will hand over FIFA in good condition," the 79-year-old told a Swiss newspaper. The comments came a day after Blatter told another Swiss daily that he had not resigned, attempting to distinguish between stepping down and giving up his mandate. On Friday, FIFA made a clarification, saying Blatter has not made a U-turn on his plans to leave office. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
chako kwangu maradhi. Matuso none kapo kwangu simanzi. Ay, tatuki tondla chako kwangu maradhi. Patashika, ay, punguza kidogo. Na mingine kadhalika, toto suna nilewa. Apo wapo liposhika, ukiongeza kidogo. Uinza koto mshuna.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Just after the midterm election a year ago, many Africans became pessimistic when the results showed that the Republican Party had captured the Senate of the United States and thereby controlled both chambers of the Congress. The general assessment of all newspapers, commentaries, and the pundits was that President Obama's presidency was over, that he had become a lame duck president, and that his presidency was a failure. Of course, President Obama, in a famous press conference, rejected that pessimistic analysis. He noted that the turnout in the election was only 37% and that it would not be correct to draw such a drastic conclusion from such a low turnout. Now, almost a year from those gloomy days, it is very clear that the predictions were all false. President Obama has been able to be a very productive president since then. There is now no more talk of President Obama as a lame duck president. His legislative programs have been successful. He has been able to block the Republicans in the Senate and in the House who attempted to kill famous program so-called Obamacare. He has been able to block any attempt to overturn his executive action programs on the issue of immigration. The Republicans have come to the realization that for them to succeed, they need to cooperate with the president. And this realization on both sides have been able to produce spectacular results. Only last week, the Senate was able to pass a very landmark decision on trade, the so-called fast-track trade bill in the Pacific, something which many Democrats oppose and the unions, but which President Obama had pushed through. Then we have seen that only last week, the Supreme Court, by a surprising 6-3 vote, has affirmed the stability of the so-called Obamacare, which means that that legislative achievement of Obama will become part of his legacy. We have also seen that the Supreme Court, in again surprising vote of 5-4, supported the Obama's program on housing by agreeing with him that the issue of intention should be brought into play in the housing program. And most surprising of all, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, has agreed to same-sex marriage throughout the United States. President Obama has also moved very close to the African-American commitments. In the first term, he was hesitant to show how close he was to them. But now it is very clear that he is not hesitating to do that, whether it's in Ferguson or in Baltimore. And now, as we have just seen, in Charleston, South Carolina. Now, the issue that remains is whether or not President Obama will achieve an agreement on Iran, where he's pushing very hard for a nuclear agreement. He has succeeded in blocking all attempts to sabotage his agreement. We will see whether he will succeed in the coming days. And in a eulogy speech, a memorable eulogy speech, which he delivered last Friday in Charleston, South Carolina, on behalf of Bishop and Senator Pinckney, he spoke as a man who is liberated. He uttered words which few politicians would dare say in public. Yes, there are those who are so awash with hatred against the president and who has less of his cerebral quality, yet have the audacity to say that he has been a failed president, and who argue daily that because he had not held a position of executive, that he therefore could not be a good president. But as the president said in that eulogy, the grace which was given to Senator Pinckney may open their eyes to see that despite the fact that President Obama may be still the no-drama Obama, he remains an enduring and successful president of the United States. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when your grandmother tells you something, you don't run to your mother to ask if it's truth. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell joined U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash, Acting Assistant Secretary of State Judith Garber, and other leaders on June 19th to destroy more than 1 ton of confiscated elephant ivory in New York's Times Square, sending a clear message that the United States will not tolerate wildlife crimes that threaten to wipe out the African elephant and a host of other species around the globe. The crush was conducted in partnership with the state of New York, the Wildlife Conservation Society, and New York State Senator Brad Hoylman. Secretary Jewell, who serves as co-chair with Secretary of State Kerry and Attorney General Lynch of the President's Task Force on Combating Wildlife Trafficking, joined Director Ash and thousands of onlookers who witnessed an industrial rock crusher, generously donated by Powerscreen, crush raw and carved ivory tusks and statues. Secretary Jewell said the ivory crush serves as a stark reminder to the rest of the world that the United States will not tolerate wildlife crimes, especially against iconic and endangered animals. The message is loud and clear. This administration will stop the poachers in their tracks, stop the profits, and work with our international partners to protect our global natural heritage. The Times Square ivory crush builds on momentum generated by the Fish and Wildlife Service's initial destruction of 6 tons of contraband ivory in November 2013. Since then, 9 governments have followed suit to destroy ivory. Campaigns to reduce demand for ivory, both domestically and overseas, and to strengthen international laws and enforcement, have further elevated the issue of wildlife trafficking globally. Regardless of their country of origin, we all lose if elephants, rhinos, tigers, and other iconic animals disappear. The only way we will save them is together through a concerted global effort to end the scourge of wildlife trafficking and the devastation it brings to these animals, said U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash. The United States, he said, underscored its commitment to winning this fight, and we call on all nations to join us by destroying their confiscated ivory stockpiles, enacting and enforcing strong regulations protecting wildlife from illegal trade, and reducing demand.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.